Bible days were the senior citizens of a town or a village. It was their responsibility to give advice, to settle disputes, and generally supervise the life of the neighborhood. And so it was natural that as the Christian church began to grow, it should evolve the same sort of system. Their leaders were called presbyteroi, or elders, from which we get our word priest, or episkopoi, meaning overseer or supervisor. And it was not until some little time later that a distinction was made between these two, and one became priests and the other became bishops. And then, as we heard in our second reading, there were the deacons. They were the people who were responsible for the administration of the church. Though it always amuses me that the longest and perhaps the most provocative sermon in the New Testament was preached by a deacon, Stephen. The same sort of thing is not unknown today. So we can picture the early church composed of small groups meeting in one another's houses and guided and led by an elder, a word which I wish that we could reintroduce, especially as women are now ordained. It's clumsy to call them women priests and offensive to call them priestesses. So I wish we could get back to that lovely old word, elder. The passage that we read just now for the first lesson and the rest of that chapter tells us how we are to treat the elders. And I think in three ways. First, we are to respect them. We do so partly because of the office to which they've been appointed. Whatever we may think of them as persons, they've been ordained by God to a sacred responsibility which we must honor and revere. We also do so because of their age, because age always brings experience and should always bring wisdom. Old age, said Ian Hay in a fine phrase, is nature's only aristocracy. And that is certainly how it was regarded in the Old Testament, where length of life was almost thought of as a mark of God's special favor. Then we're told that elders are to be rewarded, for the word translated honor should be stipend in that particular context. In other words, we have here the first example of performance-related pay. We're not told how it's to be done, or how the quality of an elder's work is to be assessed. Length of sermon, size of congregation, number of visits, I don't know. But many of you will remember the days when the incumbent was entitled to the Easter offering, when the congregation could show their appreciation or lack of it by what they put into the collection plate. Easter Day was for the vicar a benefit match. There was something to be said for the scheme, but of course it depended greatly on which county you happened to play for. Sevenoaks or Shoreditch obviously produced rather different benefits. And so the scheme was abolished, and I think rightly so, and the proceeds are pooled. Thirdly, there are occasions, of course, when an elder has to be rebuked. This must be done impartially and in the front, in the company of witnesses. And we can imagine how this must quite often have been the case in those early days, when perhaps seniority was the only qualification for leadership. But alas, of course, it's not altogether unknown today amongst qualified and ordained leaders. So much for the clergy, I don't want to concentrate upon them anymore. Many of you, by reason of your age, your qualifications, are in positions of responsibility and leadership in business, in local government, in education, in a school, a house group, and not least, in a family. Leadership at every level is just as important as it is in the case of the clergy. What makes a leader? I wrote a book some years ago with that title, and I suggested that there are, broadly speaking, two kinds of leader. We see them, I think, represented by Elijah and Elisha, but more obviously by Moses and David. Even Field Marshal Viscount Montgomery of Alamein conceded that Moses was a great guy. In fact, he went as far as saying that he was the greatest leader of all time. While Churchill, in his book Thoughts and Adventures, has a fascinating essay about Moses. Moses was uniquely equipped for his task, for he was a Hebrew by birth, but an Egyptian by upbringing. But he made a very shaky start. He had a very hot temper. He was curiously lacking in self-confidence, and at first thought he could do everything himself, until, of all people, his father-in-law taught him the secret of delegation. Once those defects were recognized and corrected, he became a leader of towering stature. Moses led from above. He was essentially the planner, the policymaker, the strategist. He had a wonderful flair for organization, and though he could think big, he had a remarkable eye for detail. We have to remember that two-thirds of his life was spent in obscurity, preparing him for the final period of phenomenal accomplishment, the escape of a whole nation from Egypt, its survival for 40 years in the desert, and its preparation to enter the Promised Land. It was a titanic achievement. David presents us with a very different style of leadership. He led not so much from above, but from amongst. I remember when we were choosing a headmaster once for a famous school, we were told that the man we eventually appointed was a boys' headmaster. And I came to see what was meant. He was never happier than when he was in the company of his pupils. He found other people to do other kinds of work, and they looked upon him, the boys did, as their flexible friend. And David was a people's leader. You wouldn't have found him at army headquarters, but in the trenches with his regiment, inspiring, encouraging, caring for his men. Today, he might not have made a great bishop, but he would have been a wonderful parish priest. David, of course, had obvious weaknesses, quite apart from his affair with Bathsheba. He could be strangely, dangerously indecisive, but he had this wonderful gift of inspiring loyalty and affection. His men would do anything for him, and they did. For you remember that occasion when he expressed a desire for a drink from the well at the gate of Bethlehem. And three men broke through the Philistine lines to produce this drink for him. And what did he do with it? He poured it out in front of the Lord. "How can I drink," he said, "the blood of these men?" Moses won the minds of people. David, I think, won their hearts. They admired Moses. They adored David. In rugby football parlance, Moses was the perfect fullback and David the scrum leader. It's probably true to say that most leaders incline in one direction or the other, Mosaic or Davidic. Just now and then, I've met someone who seems to combine both extremes. I'm thinking of my own bishop, Dr. Christopher Chavass, to whom I was chaplain for many years and who had, I think, a great influence upon my life. He combined authority and humanity to a rare degree. He could walk with kings, nor lose the common touch. His mind may have been in the study, planning the next strategic moves for his diocese. His heart was in the parish, the marketplace, the common room. And if I may go into brackets just for a moment, tomorrow afternoon at 3:30 on Channel 4, there is a program called War Heroes. And it will feature his twin brother, Noel Chavass, the only man in the First World War to win a double VC. The bar to that VC was posthumous. But the one person in whom we see the two styles of leadership perfectly combined is our Lord Jesus Christ himself. There was an otherness about him, an otherness. And even his disciples at times dared not speak to him. He loved to be alone, apart, away, in some mountain with his Father. And when he returned, it was to speak with awe-inspiring authority. Never man spake like this man, they said one to another as they listened. And yet this same Olympian figure could get alongside the humblest and the poorest people in the land. Anywhere and at any time, he could enter into conversation with people. He was equally at home with the rich and the poor, the wise and the simple, adults and little children. In one way, he was completely isolated from his fellow men, but in another way, totally involved. I often wonder what it would be like to have him amongst us today. Do you know, I have a feeling that he would be much happier to spend an evening in the White Hart chatting with the locals than taking part in a diocesan synod. Well, you say, where does all this leave me? I'm no leader. Rubbish. All of us have people living within the shadow of our influence. All of us, though we may not always know it, have people who, especially if they know we're Christians, look up to us for some sort of moral or spiritual lead. It may be, it very often is, your own children. It may be your younger brothers and sisters, your siblings, friends at school or at college, members of your house group, and so on. We never know when other people are taking their time from us. We cannot shrug off our influence on others any more than we can shrug off a shadow on a sunny day. Does this thought fill you with some trepidation? I suppose in a sense it ought to, that you're the person by whom others are seeking to steer their lives. It didn't worry Paul. He was able to say, be followers, literally be imitators of me, because he was able to go on to say, as I am of Christ. In other words, if Jesus Christ is our leader, we're living close to him, we may be perfectly confident that we're leading people in the right direction. But we may never know when our decision to take the choice of the hard right instead of the easy wrong will not lead some other person to say, thank God I met you. the end of the story. It's a story about a parson, a minister, on the west coast of Scotland. It was his duty to take services in a little church on the headland in a very remote corner. On this particular night, there was a tremendous storm blowing. Never had his study fire seemed more appealing, or the weather more appalling. For a while, he struggled with his conscience, feeling fairly sure that no one would be there. But in the end, his sense of duty and his conscience prevailed. He struggled to this little church. When he got there, as he expected, there was no one. He put his lantern on the windowsill. He knelt for a few minutes to say his prayers. And then, when no one appeared, he fought his way home through the storm. He thought no more about it. To him, it had been a normal response to the call of duty. But some weeks later, he heard that out at sea that night, floundering in the storm, there had been a ship, hopelessly off course and not knowing where it was. Suddenly, a light appeared on the headland. It was there just long enough for the master of that ship to take a fresh bearing, to set a new course, and to reach the harbour he was trying to find. And you and I may never know when our choice to choose the right course may not lead some other person to be eternally grateful that we've helped them. Of course, it's not easy. In the eyes of the world, we're going in the wrong direction. If you've ever walked away from a football match when everyone is walking towards it, you know how hard it can be to walk against the crowd, and particularly to lead others with you. But remember, you can only conduct the orchestra if you turn your back on the crowd.